Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Birshut Rabbanim, Rabbi Brander, Rabbi Lebha, Rabbi Stern, the Avrechim of the Kolel, I was asked to come here tonight to do my impersonation of Rabbi Mansour. I do it well. The theme of the night, obviously, as I'm hearing from all the speakers, is Torah, its centrality, its importance, its key element in sustaining our nation. I feel very comfortable talking about this topic because I myself am also an Avrech. That is my primary role. It's true, I fly around and I go give speeches here and there, but my primary role in life is actually a Kolel student. I sit on a daily basis with my study partner, my Havruta, and we battle the arguments of Avaye and Rabbah, Bet Hillel and Bet Shammai. And as Rabbi Brander said, we travel the world from the Mishnah in Israel and the Gemara in Babylonia to Europe and to the Middle East, just in order to understand the words of Chachamim. So this speech over here, I don't need notes. I just wrote the notes so I don't forget the names of the rabbis. But I don't need to prepare this talk. This is in my blood. Ladies and gentlemen, but I think the problem that we have is, we talk very nice. We bring the rabbis up here and we showcase them in front of everybody as if, not too sure what the purpose of that is. Kolel people are regular human beings like everybody else. They come up here and we look at them, maybe it was proper, so we stand up for them and give them the honor. But what I think our problem is that with all the talk and all the hype, we are taking our position for granted. The fact that we have this book called the Torah Kedosha and all its laws and all its lifestyle, most of us, I know there are exceptions in the crowd, as I've heard tonight, the previous speakers, some of the guests, but most of the members have been born into this religion. And we've been born into a religious life, and it has become a matter of fact. It has become a way of life. And when things become matter of fact, they become unfortunately pedestrian, and they become routine, and the regularity causes it to become a little stale, and a little old, and it loses its vim, it loses its excitement, and we forget how lucky we are. I had a rabbi in high school. I went to a very small high school. There was only 9 boys in our class. We started the high school in 1982. And the rabbi always had to motivate us that you're in a yeshiva high school, you're doing something great. When the rest of the world was lost, they were gallivanting and they were drowning in whatever they were doing. So the rabbi always had to remind us, you're lucky. And he would look at us with a straight face and say, boys, you must know you have won the lottery of life. And it always sticks with me, those words. How lucky we are. Asher baharvanu. But tonight, I came to prove to you and to myself and to remind ourselves indeed how fortunate we are. I begin with the Gemara in Shabbat. It's well known. The Gemara says when Moshe Rabbeinu went up to receive the Torah, he left planet Earth, he went out into outer space, and he eventually reached the heavens. Little did Moshe Rabbeinu know that there was going to be a major protest taking place that day. And it was the angels that were protesting. They were rioting. And they tell God Almighty, Mali lud isha benenu. What is this human being of flesh and blood? What does he want here? Why does he come here? What is his interest? Borei Olam answers the angels and says, Lekabel Torah ba. He came to receive the Torah. And the angel said, what? This Torah is called Hemda Genuza. It is a prized treasure. This Torah was written 974 generations before the world was even created. Tatka'ad Dorot. And this Torah you're going to give to mortal human beings. Ma'enosh ki tizkerenu, uben Adam ki tifkedenu. Humans are not worthy of this book. This religion and this doctrine must remain in a hermetically sealed environment. It must remain in heaven. It must be studied by angels only. And therefore they refused to part with the Torah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu goes to Moshe Rabbeinu and he says, well, give them an answer. Tell them why you think you're deserving. Moshe Rabbeinu tells God, I am afraid to respond because they might burn me with the fire that is exuding from their mouths. God says, don't worry about their fire. Hold on to the Kiseh HaKavod and retort and respond to them. Va'azir lahem teshuvah. Ladies and gentlemen, a few years back on one of my trips to Eretz Yisrael, I had the great merit, as I usually did, to spend some very quality time with Chacham Avadya Yosef Alav HaShalom, our great master and teacher, the Gadol Ador. And in that meeting, he actually quoted this Gemara. And he asked a question. He said, the angels have a claim. He said, anybody can have claims. When you go to Bet Din, it's not enough that you have a claim. You have to have something to substantiate your claim. I cannot come into court and say, hey, that's my shirt. Why? Because I said so. They'll throw it out. Do you have proof? Do you have witnesses? You must prove your claim. You must substantiate it. So he says, what was the claim of the angels? Just because they said, Mali Ludi Sha Benenu, what is this mortal human being? What? That's not a claim. Well, that's not a proof of anything. That's not acceptable in Bet Din. It's mine. So he said something incredible. He said, actually, the angels came with a very, very strong claim. And their claim emanates from the Torah itself. I know it's not a shi'ur in halakha, but allow me to oversimplify a law that's written in the Shulchan Aruch. A fellow came along and he put a for sale sign on his house. And not too long after that, a fellow from out of town saw the sign, and he says, it's a beautiful house, it's a dream house. We were always thinking about such a property. We'll take it. They shake hands, they sign a contract, they give a deposit, he takes the for sale sign off. The seller walks out of his house and he bumps into his neighbor. The neighbor lives right next door. He says, I saw that for sale sign. Whatever happened with that? He says, well, we get a mazal tov, we sold it. To who? A fellow came from Tennessee, new guy on the community, he bought it. He said, well, I'm very offended. How come you didn't come to me first? I'm your neighbor. Shouldn't you give me the right of first refusal? This house over here would be perfect for me. I could extend my house. This guy from Tennessee, he doesn't have any advantage living here or down the block. But to me, I'm a neighbor. I'm very, very offended. He said, well, I'm sorry you're offended. We had a good relationship for all the years we lived on the block. I'm sorry we have to leave on a sour note, but that's what it is. C'est la vie. He says, no, c'est la vie. He says, I'm going to take it to Bet Din. I want to hear the rabbi's opinion. Okay, we'll go to Bet Din. What is the rabbi going to say? I already made a contract. We shook hands and I took money. They go to the rabbinical court, and amazingly enough, the rabbi says, the neighbor is right. There's a law in the Torah that says, Ve'asita et hayashar ve'hatov. You must do what's proper. You must do what is just. The Torah says you must do what's right. And what? How does that manifest itself? The Gemara Baba Batra says there's a law called Bar Mitzra. Bar Mitzra means the law of the neighbor. Neighbors have first rights because it's the right thing to do. The neighbor has a vested interest to buy the property that's next to his. And therefore the Torah law says that contract that you sold to the outsider is null and void. It is batel. Rip it up and the neighbor gets the property. That's the law of the Torah. So the angels came along and said to God, you know why we want the Torah? Because the Torah says that it belongs to us. After all, we've been the neighbor of the Torah for 974 generations. Moshe Rabbeinu comes from a place that is light years away, further than Tennessee. And he comes along now and says he wants to take this Torah from us. We are invoking the law of Bar Mitzra. We've been the loyal neighbor of it, and therefore we want to hold on to it. Chacham Avadya said, that's a claim. That's not just saying it's mine, I want it. That's a halakhic claim, and they're reading it from the book, from the Torah itself. So then the Chacham said, well, what was Moshe Rabbeinu's counterclaim? Obviously, he has to defend himself, and he has to defend us. What was his claim? So the Chacham said, it's based on a shita mekubetzet, an opinion of a rabbi called Rav Yitzhak Alfasi, a true story that happened. I'm paraphrasing the story to make it easier to digest. Same story. Our fellow that sold the house had another house. He put it up for sale again. But he told his wife, we're not going to make the same mistake we did last time. We're going to go to the neighbors first. You live and learn. He went to the neighbor on the right. He said, I appreciate the courtesy. It's very kind of you. It's a nice gesture, but thank you very much. We're not interested. It's okay, Baruch Hashem. At least I feel my conscience is clear that I went to the neighbor first. So his wife says, but you have another neighbor on the other side. You have to clear it with him also. He says, you're right. Goes to the other neighbor. He says, you know, our house is coming up for sale. Before we put the sign up, we went to a rabbi. We went through this already. We're giving you right of first refusal. He says, I'm so glad you came to us. As a matter of fact, we're interested in the house. He says, well, it's your right. Do you know that you're called the Bar Mitzra? Do you know that the Torah says, Va'asita Tayashar Ba'atov? It's your right. It's coming to you. They write up a contract, they shake hands, and they pass money. That night, the owner of the house is celebrating with his wife that it was such an easy thing, and he's happy that he did the right thing. Live and learn. That night, his son comes over and says, Dad, I know you were thinking, you and Mommy were thinking about selling the house. What ended up happening? Oh, my son, listen to an unbelievable hashkaha. There's a law called Bar Mitzra. We went to the neighbor. You should be very proud of your father. He did the right thing once in his life. And he sold it to him. And it's a good thing. And it's the blessing of the rabbis. And the son tells him, what are you talking about? Why didn't you come to me first? I lived in this house. I was raised in this house. I was born in this house. I have sentimental value in this house. There's nostalgia. Why don't you come to me? The father says, because you're not a Bar Mitzra. He said, what do you mean I'm not a Bar Mitzra? I'm your son. Flesh and blood. We share the same DNA. You're not a Bar Mitzra and you're not a rabbi. He says, well, with all due respect, my dear father, I'm going to have to take you to the Beit Din. Not to be confrontational, just to know the truth. He says, fine. How come every time I sell a house, we have to go to Beit Din? So they go back to the Beit Din, and the rabbi says, oh, you again? He says, Rabbi, I don't understand. Bar Metzla. He says, yes, Bar Metzla. So what does he want? He said, well, that's my son. Well, what is his claim? His claim is, I don't know, that he's a son. He feels somehow he should go first. And the rabbi says, he's right. Halakha says that a son is closer, even though he might not be geographically closer, but emotionally closer he is to the house and to the father. And therefore, in the law of Bar Metzla, the son is closer. Chaim Avadia Yosef then said that Moshe Rabbeinu took out the Torah and said to the angels, true, you are geographically closer. The Torah has been in heaven for 974 generations. I cannot argue that. However, in the same book that you come from, it says regarding our relationship with God, Banim Atem LaHashem, that we are considered God's children. And if we're considered God's children and your claim is Bar Metzla, you have proven our case. And therefore, Torah belongs on earth. The children have rights of first refusal, and we are going to take our option. And at that point, the Gemara says, Moshe Rabbeinu won the argument. The argument belongs to Moshe. At that point, I was so amazed the way Chacham Avadia's halachic mind could read this piece of agadaic literature and right away infuse in it Jewish law with a lot of brazenness. I asked the Chacham if I could just add my 2 cents to the great chidush that he had just expounded. He said, by all means. And of course, my voice was shaking, and I was nervous to say it to him, but with great siyata nishma, he accepted it. I said, Chacham, now I understand that really we are closer than the angels. Because the Jewish soul is created from a place that is higher than the angels. Our souls emanate from heaven. But where in heaven? In heaven there are many worlds. There's a world called Biriyah. Lower than that, there's a world called Yetzirah. Those are worlds primarily that belong to angels. However, the Jewish soul emanates from under the chair of God, from the Tahat Kiseh HaKavod. Our position is closer than the angels. So if you want to argue Bar Metzla, not only are we God's children, but if you look at the origin of the Jewish soul, we are indeed closer. We come from a closer place. Olam ha'atzilut. Atzilut comes from the Hebrew word etzel. We are close. And that's why when God told Moshe, answer them. They have a good claim, answer them. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, I'm afraid. I'm afraid from the fire that's exuding from their mouth. That means I'm afraid of their argument. That fire is the fire of their claim. I don't know how to answer it. So God says, I'll tell you how to answer it. God was giving Moshe the answer. God told him, hold on to the Kiseh HaKavod and give them the answer. Because that's the answer. The Kiseh HaKavod is the answer. You're closer. If they're coming from the claim of Bar Metzra, tell them that you came from the Kiseh HaKavod, a place that even the angels do not reach. The Chacham put on a big smile, and thank God he accepted it. But what do I learn from this Gemara? I learned that we have a book that the angels were vying for. And they lost the argument. That means we have something that even Malachim do not have the same access that we have. We have a commodity that the angels would take in a moment, in a blink. And they had to fight Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu took the Torah, it was held captive by the Malachim. And we have it, it belongs to us. That means in heaven the angels are jealous of us. They covet us. They said, how is it? Mortal human beings, and they got something that we would take any day. Problem is, we take it for granted. We don't realize that we have something that even Malachi HaSharet cannot get their hands on. But I'll tell you something else. Today is May 24th, 2017. Some of you might not be aware of this day in history. Well, it's not current history. It's May 24th, 1749. An amazing event happened. An event that actually changed the world, as I will show you in a moment. The story begins, if anybody ever went to Poland, I was just there on a trip in the holy city of Krakow, the Bet Knesset of Rabbi Moshe Isserlish, and the great cemetery of all the tzaddikim. But not too far from there, there's a city called Lanchut. Lanchut is an enormous castle or a palace. It takes 10 minutes just to walk around the circumference of this property. And this palace belonged to one of the noble families in Poland. They called them the Potocki family. Very, very, very wealthy. They owned 999 properties like this throughout Poland. They were also very religious. Christian, very connected to the church. And one of their children, I guess he was a prince, his name was Valentin Potocki. And he was studying in Paris to become a minister or a priest. One night he went into a hotel, as the story is told, and the owner of the hotel was Jewish, an old man, and the old man was reading a book. And he was reading it intently. Potocki tells the old man, "What are you reading? You don't take your head out of the book. What's in the book?" He says, "This is not for you." "What do you mean it's not for me? I want to see the book. Tell me what's in the book." Happened to me was the Torah. And the proprietor starts to read the Torah to Potocki, and he gets turned on. Before you know it, he converts to Judaism, which was considered a capital offense at the time. And he goes missing because he knew he could not go back to his family because his family will ostracize him. Anyway, there's a informer that tells the father of Valentin that his son is converted. They bring him back to Lanchut, and the father starts to impress upon him, "What are you, out of your mind? You've converted to Judaism. You're an abomination to our family. You're embarrassing the name. Renounce your Judaism." And they bring all the priests and the ministers to try to talk him out of it, and they tell him, "If you renounce your Judaism, all 999 properties will belong to you, besides the great property in Lanchut." By this time, Valentin, his name was Avraham, like converts take that name, and he said, "Impossible. You cannot give me anything. I have had an encounter with the truth, and nobody will be able to take that truth away from me." They said, "But we're going to kill you." He said, "So be it." The story is told. He lived in the times of the Gaon Mevilna. And they promised not only to kill him, but to pulverize him, to torture him, to throw him into a fiery furnace like Avraham Avinu, and turn his body into ash. The Gaon Mevilna told them, "I will give you a holy name of God from the Kabbalah, and you won't feel any pain." Avraham, from the family of Potocki, said, "I'm not interested. Doesn't bother me to feel the pain for Judaism. Doesn't bother me to feel a little tsar, a little anguish for the truth. It's worth it." And on that day, May 24th, 1749, they made a big bonfire in the middle of the city. They took this fellow who would be called Avraham ben Avraham, and they threw him into the fire until he became all ash. Eventually they took his ashes and they buried it next to the Gaon Mevilna. That was his request, to be buried next to the ashes of this Sadiq, of this Ger Tzedek. As a matter of fact, the Hafetz Chaim said that that moment was such a pivotal moment in Jewish history that if there would have been 10 men, Jews, standing at that moment when Avraham was thrown into the fire for being Jewish, and they would have said the Kaddish, Mashiach would have came at that moment. The Gaon de Vilna said the Kiddusha at that moment was so intense that from that moment on, there is no more Tum'ah of Yadayim. When we wash our hands in the morning, he said, it's not because there's Tum'ah anymore. That Tum'ah, that contamination, left the world when Avraham Aguirre jumped in. Today, May 24th, we're commemorating that moment. But that year, May 24th, actually was on the second day of Shavuot. And I said to myself, I don't believe that's a coincidence. Because that's another perfect example of somebody that was willing to give up everything. Money, prestige, honor, clout. Was willing to give up all the benefits of being a nobleman because he understood that the Torah is on a higher level of nobility. Mamlechet Kohanim v'goy kadosh. That story happens on Shavuot to remind us that look what the angels were vying for and look what he was willing to give up in order to join it. And we have it on a silver platter. And we've been born with it and we live with it. And we take it for granted. But you have to look at these stories of others, what they would have done and what they did in order to be connected to it. No coincidence why that episode happens on the second day of Shavuot. But there's a story that we read on the first day of Shavuot, which is a similar story. There's a princess. Her name is called Ruth. She's the daughter of a king of Moab. Well, I have to assume she lived in the lap of luxury. Dresses, you know, ornate. She lived in a very, very comfortable quarters. She must have had maids and servants and butlers. She must have all the jewelry and all the amenities of life. She's the princess. She's the daughter of a king, Ruth. And at a certain point, she marries into a Jewish noble family, but very quickly she finds herself alone, without a husband, with her mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law Naomi tells Ruth, this aristocratic girl, I have nothing to offer you. Go back home to your father's house. Go back to your comfortable life. Ruth says, nothing doing. I'm accepting upon myself Judaism. Naomi says, Judaism has nothing to offer you. We're not even sure we can provide for you a new husband. Go back home. Go back to the comfortable life. Go back to the enjoyment. Go back to a place that can give you peace and tranquility. Ruth says, where you go, I will go. And where you die, I will die. And as you know the story, Ruth not only becomes Jewish, but she accepts upon herself a life of destitution. Destitution means she was poverty stricken to the extent she would have to go to the fields and collect the gleanings. I don't know if you have that over here in California, but by us in New York, we have early in the morning, you hear people rustling in our garbage cans to get the recyclables, to get the, you know, the 5 cent bottles. And obviously, they need it if they're doing it, but it's a very menial thing. Imagine somebody has to stoop to that level. We have to rummage into a garbage can to get a dirty can in order to redeem it for a nickel. It's pathetic. Naomi did worse. She's rummaging in fields, picking up stalks of wheat to collect them to maybe make a piece of dough. And where did she come from? She came from the palace. She was a daughter of a queen. And why did she give it all up? because Judaism is worth it. That's the story of the first day of Shavuot. There were people that understood what we take for granted, and they were willing to give up much more than we'll ever have. We complain about the difficulties of our Judaism and the inconveniences and the tirhot. Look what these people gave up in fact, indeed, just to be part of it. That's a motivating story. So between the first day of Shavuot, the story of Ruth, the first day of Shavuot when Moses went up and took it from the angels, the second day of Shavuot of Valentin Putatsky, a.k.a. Avraham ben Avraham Ager. But there's another story that always coincides with Shavuot. And that comes from the reading of the Torah. Everybody must know that the reading on the first day of Shavuot comes from Parashat Yitro. There's another perfect example. Yitro was the, well, you'd call him the head of the church of the day. Yitro had prestige, he had honor, he had glory, he had money. And Yitro gives up everything. For what? To go join the Jewish people and to become a secondary, a subsidiary to the Jewish nation. Another story of somebody that gave up everything. But again, since we've been born with it, we forget how lucky we are. So you need to hear those stories of people that realized how valuable it is. Sometimes you have to learn from the outside is to remind us what we're sitting on. We're sitting on a treasure. There was a teacher in a college in Odessa, a Jewish teacher, but everybody else around them, in Russia, all communists, all atheists, and they weren't too happy that one of the professors in their college was Jewish. So they came to him once and they said, "We want to offer you a promotion in your professorship. On one condition, you must renounce your Judaism." And they thought, he'll do it because anyway he wasn't even religious. He was just Jewish because his mother was Jewish. They didn't feel he had any connection, and he didn't have any connection. So they felt it's easy for him to renounce it so they can write on their roster that they have no Jews teaching in their college. And they offered him, like I said, a promotion. Well, this Jewish teacher was very, very wise. He turned to them and he said, "You're asking me to renounce something that I know nothing about. Why would I renounce it? First, let me go study it. Let me go analyze it. And then I'll tell you if it's worth it for me to renounce it or not. It wouldn't be prudent for me to just say, I don't want something. I don't know what it is." And then he thought to himself and he said, "And if you're trying to take it away from me, my inclination tells me that it must be very valuable. Because why else would you want to take it from me? So I don't know what this Judaism is, but I see that you're bent on taking it from me. Already I'm concerned that I am sitting on something that's very expensive." P.S. He went to study his Judaism. And of course he saw that he was sitting on a treasure. And that's why everybody keeps on wanting to take it away from us throughout the generations. So you have to learn from your enemies. Learn from our enemies. There's a reason why they always come after us. Because we have something valuable. We have the commodity that the angels don't have. If that's the case, ladies and gentlemen, you have something going for you here in Los Angeles, amongst a lot of things. Weather, and good spirit, good feeling, good people. You have, Baruch Hashem, a great institution in the Link. An organization that's not taking Judaism for granted. A very fresh organization, young organization, vibrant. And that's giving a good plug or a good charge or a rejuvenation of spirit to the entire town, to the entire city. But, however, all these great institutions, they don't run on fumes, they need money. You didn't come here tonight to hear long-winded speeches, to hear impersonations, and to eat a good dinner. All that's very nice, but it's not going to pay any bills, and it's not going to buy any buildings. We came here for a purpose. We cannot forget ourselves. Rabbi Meir Shapiro once got up in a derasha, and he spoke a long derasha, a whole pilpul, back and forth, quoting Gemariot all over the place. At the end of a 45-minute dissertation, he turned to the congregation. He said, "Did anybody understand what I'm talking about here tonight?" And a young boy raises his hand and says, "Rebbe, I understood every word you said." He said, "What did I say?" He says, "Basically, you said you need money." Rabbi Meir Shapiro said, "He's the only one that understood me." And that's basically what we're saying here tonight in different ways. Everybody's getting up here at the pulpit in their own way. But I'm going back to New York in a few hours, so I'm saying it directly. I don't have time to beat around the bush over here tonight. Yeshiva needs money. It's as simple as that. But I will tell you in conclusion something that I heard at a parlor meeting that I attended once for the great Rosh Yeshiva of David Feinstein, Yishmerei Wael. At that parlor meeting, one of the administrators, I guess it was, got up and told the following story. Made a big impact on me, and I'll share it with you tonight. He said that in the olden days in one of the European cities, there was a royal family called the Romanovs, Romanov family. I don't know if this is a true story or a fable. There was indeed a Romanov family, but nonetheless, the lesson is true. The moral of the story is definitely true. Anyway, the king of that family one day made a royal decree that no Jews are to be found in the marketplace. And any Jew that will be found in the marketplace on that given day will be subject to severe penalty and incarceration. And the king dispatched his officers to the market to investigate to see if any Jews were disobeying his orders. And sure enough, they see a Jewish guy, very Jewish, peor, beard, the whole costume. And it's clear that he's Jewish. He says, "Are you aware that the king has made a decree that there's no Jews to be in the market?" He says, "I have no choice. The market needs me." He says, "Who are you?" "What do you mean the market needs you? What are you?" He says, "I'm a maven." "It's a maven? What's a maven?" "Maven means I understand things. I'm a mevin, and people need my advice. Should they buy? Should they sell? Is it a good idea? The market cannot afford for me to miss even one day." The officer says, "Well, we never heard of this career called mevin. The king has not made any exceptions. You are going to be incarcerated." "So be it." They threw him in prison. The next day, the king was offered to buy a very, very precious, rare diamond. But the king doesn't know too much about diamonds and their worth. The officer says, "Wait." The officer says, "Wait," to the king. "There's a maven in the prison." He says, "What's a maven?" He says, "A maven? A maven is somebody that understands everything." He says, "Fine." Maven comes out, and the officer says, "This is the prince, the king's son, and he has a diamond that he wants to ask you about, and I told him you're the maven." He says, "Fine." He says, "Let me see the diamond." He looks at it. He says, "Well, how much they want for this?" They said, "Millions of rubles." He said, "This is a fake diamond. This is a hoax." He says, "How do you know?" He says, "Bring me a hammer." He takes the hammer. He says, if it's a real diamond, you won't be able to shatter it. But if it's glass, it'll crack into a million pieces. And sure enough, he smashes it right in the middle and it shatters into a million pieces. The prince tells him, you're a maven. You really understand things. You've saved me millions of rubles. As a reward, I present you with 500 rubles. And then he sends him back into prison. He goes back to prison with 500 rubles in his pocket. The prince, of course, is very happy. The next day, the prince is offered a very rare Egyptian stallion, horse. But he doesn't know, is it worth it, is it not? Call the maven. Call the maven out of jail. Do you know anything about horses? He says, I know about everything. What do you think of this horse that they're presenting? He looks in the eyes of the horse. He says, my dear prince, this is a killer horse. The rider of this horse will be bucked and trampled by the horse within 2 minutes. Do not buy the horse. He says, how do I know that? He says, do you have an enemy of the state? Bring your worst enemy and let him ride that horse and you'll see. Sure enough, they bring the enemy of the state. He gets on the horse. Within 2 minutes, the horse bucks the rider off and tramples him to death. The prince comes along and says, you saved my life. 500 rubles. But he says, before I send you back to prison, you seem like a very smart guy. You know about diamonds. You know about horses. But now I want you to tell me something about myself. Tell me something that even I don't know about myself. And of course the maven was uncomfortable. He says, no, what's to say? You're from the royal family, you're Romanovs. There's nothing to say. He says, no. You must know a secret about myself that even I don't know. Even that I am not aware of. The maven says, you leave me no choice. He looks in the prince's eyes and he says to him, you're not a Romanov. He says, what do you mean I'm not a Romanov? My father's the king. My mother's the queen. Listen to what I'm telling you. You're not a Romanov. So how could that be? But I'm the prince. I'm the heir to the throne. You could be the heir to the throne, but you're not a real Romanov. Well, the prince was infuriated. He sends him back to prison. And he runs to his mother. He says, Mom, am I a real Romanov? He says, of course. What kind of question is that? Who put these ideas in your mind? He says, well, is it possible that I'm not? Impossible. You would tell me if I wasn't? Of course I would tell you. There's nothing to tell you. And he keeps on pressing and pressing and pressing. Finally, his mother breaks down crying. And his mother says, my dear son, we weren't able to have children. There was not going to be a perpetuation of this throne. We found you. You weren't born to us. It's true, you're not a Romanov. He couldn't believe it. How did the maven know? He went back to the prison. He tells the Jewish maven, how in the world did you know that I'm not a Romanov? He said it was actually quite simple. You asked me about a diamond, and I saved you a considerable amount of money, and you rewarded me 500 rubles. The next day I saved your life from the wild horse. And you reward me the same 500 rubles. Anybody that cannot discern between money and life is not a true Romanov. There is no way you have royal blood running through your veins if you cannot make a simple distinction between life and money. You are not royal. Your thinking is petty. You think like a commoner. And then the rabbi got up and said, ladies and gentlemen, we came here tonight to talk about life. Ki em hayenu ve'orech yamenu. We talk about religion and Torah, which is our mainstay. But for this to exist in its proper way, we need money. And if we can't understand the difference between money and life, then we are not true Romanovs ourselves. Then we do not deserve distinction, the distinction that the Torah refers to us as Mamlechet Kohanim. We are considered royal family. But in a royal family, we must understand that there's priorities. Life comes before money. Money is nothing against life. And therefore, it must be very, very easy for us in order to expend money for a higher order, for a higher priority. And my blessing to the great rabbis and avrechim, who are clearly underpaid. It was said, but it should be said again, substandard salaries in a very expensive city. That's part of the mesirut nefesh that they endure on a daily basis, and they do it out of love. These tzaddikim are holding up the whole city, if not the whole country, if not the whole world. We must be very grateful for them. But they deserve a place, a house, a building, something, minimum wages, minimum standard living quarters. And therefore I say tonight, Rabotai, it's only money. Money is nothing against what we're providing, what it's going to give back. And don't forget, you're sitting on a treasure that the Malachim would take back any second, a treasure that Avraham on this date jumped into a fire for and gave up everything. Ruth accepted a life of poverty to collect cans from the garbage, but to remain Jewish and not to go back to the palace. And Yitro renounced his popehood in order to join Klal Yisrael. Let us not take our Yehadut for granted. And I bless you all that you should always be in a position to give. And with that I say the Pasuk, Ki lekach tov natati lachem. God says, I gave you a good item. I gave you a good item. It's lekach tov. And if God says it's lekach tov, rest assured it's lekach tov. But one condition, Torati al ta'azovu. Don't abandon it. Don't let it wither. Don't let it grow stale. Don't let it grow old. Torati al ta'azobu. Thank you very much.